Good morning, everyone. Thank you, poor kids. I had to move to the back. Sorry about that, guys. Thanks for doing that, though. See if I can save a little voice. Actually, I started out the week with a little bit of a sore throat and probably from not sleeping well. Still adjusting to the time change. It's actually almost about a total 12-hour change coming here compared to back home, so we have to get used to staying awake all night and staying and going to sleep during the day, and it's just... That's a tough one. But, James, let's see where we're at. Now, today, we're hoping to get into some of the really practical things in the story of James today when he writes his letter and have a look at what James is really after. You know, so far, we've got the basics down. I really think that up there on the board right now, that's really what James was after is the basic intent. That's almost like the bottom framework. This is the foundation of his letter. It has to come from the fact that we really believe and we trust the fact that God's involved in every aspect of our life. And he does that through angels. And the angels are out there with us all the time. They're here now. They go with us everywhere. And they're watching the things that happen. They look at events that are occurring. And they make decisions about how those events are going to happen. Because they're guiding us and they're trying to direct us, as any parent would, in trying to raise their children up to the family of God. And if we have that confidence in our God, then it changes the way we live. It changes the way you react to things in your life. You're going down the freeway, and you're going down the road. All of a sudden, somebody comes in and cuts you off. And the mind of the flesh says, oh, what's the matter with that person? And you're all upset at them cutting you off on the road. And the spiritual mind says, I wonder what the angels are trying to do right now. I wonder why they're slowing me down. I wonder why they brought this event into my life. This is what happens in our life, and it really changes the way you live, changes the way you react to people, and it really gives us the peace of God that passes all understanding, because we have that confidence that in everything, God is working for good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. So that's what James is going to have a look at right now. So what we want to do then is finish up chapter 1 and hopefully move into chapter 2. Chapter 1 looks at some of the godly characteristics at the end here. He's going to just finish off with some of the things that we need to endure our trials, because he knows his focus in this letter is specifically on trials that are coming upon those that have been scattered abroad. But we know ourselves that you can take that letter then and apply that to whatever trials that God brings into your life as well. It doesn't have to be just persecution. So what he ended up with yesterday, when we ended up with that section there about how God's of his own will, he brought us forth by the word of truth, and we have that confidence that God hasn't made any mistakes. It's God's election. Every person here has been picked by God. He wants you all, and it's of his will that you have been brought forth and reborn by the word of truth. And when you believe that then, and you really understand it, he's doing that so that you can be reborn and be like a kind of first fruits that he says of his creatures in verse 18. Therefore then in verse 19, here's what this means. Here's what happens then when we come into trials. When somebody cuts us off, when a brother or sister says something at meeting, when our spouse has had a bad day and they say something to us, we don't just react like the man of the flesh. Instead, what we do is we become swift to hear, and we become slow to speak, and we become slow to wrath. This is the impact of the implanted word in your life, when you really believe that God is in it all. So that if somebody is mistreating us, if somebody does have a bad day, and they do things that they really shouldn't do, we don't react back at them and take vengeance. We don't react like a natural person would of this world. Instead, we try to figure out, how can we help them? What are we supposed to learn from this? That's the focus of our life. And this brings a lot of peace into your life, brothers and sisters. It just studies us out, helps us be a calm and collected person, and we don't have to react to all those things that are going on. We learn to be very slow to speak and swift to hear, so we listen, which is what any good counselor will do. You just listen. I found that with kids at school when I was dealing with all these people that would come to school with all their problems, what's been going on at home. And the best thing you can do for people is listen. When folks are going through problems, they want somebody to talk to. And we learn to listen to what's going on in their life and try to figure out where they're coming from. And James's point is, the reason you do that is because the wrath of man is not going to produce the righteousness of God. So what James is going to give us then, at the end of chapter 1 right now, is he's going to give us some specific tools. Just like those of you that have swimming pools. I mean, when we moved out to California, we got a swimming pool. I had to get one of these little test kits right there, because I can't just look in my pool and figure out, well, how much chlorine is in there today? I don't have the ability to do that. I can't test that pH really good just by looking at the water. Maybe somebody can feel it and know the pH. Remember that pH scale last night? pH scale. Anybody knew that pH scale? That was good. He went from 0 to 14. That's good. A lot of people think it goes from 1 to 14. So we have these little pool test kits that allow us to test the pH of our swimming pools. I don't think very many of us are really good at figuring out exactly what the temperature is outside, although you get pretty good at it. But humidity, that's a little questionable thing too. So we have all these little tools. So what James is going to do is he's going to pick some specific things that you can look at in your life that make it very obvious to us about how we're doing on developing this character of God and really believing that God's involved in our life. Because what will happen is a lot of times we give an assent to it and we say, oh yeah, I believe God's involved in every aspect of my life. And then somebody does something to us and we react like we don't believe that at all. And so James won't let us wiggle out of that. He's not going to let us like sneak out of that concept. Instead, he's going to say, well, how are you doing on this? And how are you doing on that? And how are you doing on this aspect of your life? And try to give us some very specific cases of, do we really believe that this is all of God and God's the one involved in our life? And so he's going to wonder, like, how do we measure up? And any of you that have tried to go on a diet or you've tried to lose any weight, you all know what it's like, that you get on the scale and you think maybe for a couple of days you think you're doing pretty good. Think, we're really making progress. And then you get on the scale and find out, oops, maybe it wasn't going quite the way I expected. And this is what James does, is he lays out the scale. And he says, get on the scale and look at it and find out, how are you really doing? Not just, how do you think you're doing? So that's why I like the book of James, because his point is that the wrath of man doesn't produce the righteousness of God. So when we get angry at people, and when we react to situations in our life, and we come out the way we do, that indicates to us that we really don't believe that God is in it. Because if we did, we wouldn't react like that. You would never treat your spouse like that. If you really believe that God has provided this spouse for you because they're going to bring all the things into your life that you need to have the rough edges knocked off of your stone so you will fit into God's temple, if you really believe that, you won't treat your spouse in negative ways. You won't react. You won't get all excited about things and react the wrong way. You just won't do that. Because you'll look at the situation and you'll try to figure out, what am I supposed to learn from this? How can I help this other person get through this experience? And you calm down, you settle down, and you do the same thing with your kids. You do the same thing in ecclesial life. And instead of the wrath of man, you start to see people who are developing the spiritual mind. And people do to become what James would call, you become doers of the word. Not doers of works of law, but doers of the word. We actually live out in our lives the character of God and of Jesus Christ. So the only way to do it, James would say, is that through meekness, realizing meekness, because you realize it's not in me. It's not that I'm better than somebody else and I'm going to really try hard and I'm going to develop the character of God. Now, none of us have it from the beginning. We all start out with this negative slate, not even a blank slate. We start out with a negative mind that wants to react in anger. We want to take vengeance. We want to do all those nasty things by nature. This is the way we all are. And instead, what we have to do is receive with meekness the implanted word, understanding that only through the impact of the word, that's the only thing that's going to change our life. And if you really believe that, then how could you ever go a day without listening to the word? We wouldn't want to do that. You'd be like, during the day, at some point every day, you're going to want to get out a Bible. You want to get out some tapes. You're going to want to get out your MP3 player. You're going to want to go to a class somewhere. You're going to want to do something every day to try to get this brain to raise it above the level of the natural man. And we will receive with meekness that implanted word. This is why I really believe that, you know, doing some kind of Bible readings or listening to Bible tapes or something every day is the best thing we can do. We get in the car, we plug in a CD, or you use your MP3 players today, and we listen to the Bible for a while, and we just calm our minds down. We get thinking about spiritual things. We meditate upon those things, because this natural brain right here isn't going to react in a godly way. You have to actually put something foreign into it, the implanted word, and then this is like a seed that gets inside this brain of ours and it starts to grow. And what it does is it grows the spiritual mind. So as Paul would deal with this same issue in Romans 8, he talks about the mind of the spirit versus the mind of the flesh. And Paul deals with this issue and says, look, if you are children of God, If you really are children of God, then the mind of the Spirit will overcome the mind of the flesh. And it won't do it every time. He admitted that back in Romans 7. He admits that there's times where you're going to fail. But what you're after is the hope that that mind of the Spirit will overcome the mind of the flesh. So what you then do instead is you become a doer of the word. You jump out of your natural box and you don't just do the stuff that you want to do, but instead you do things that help other people. So you're not just comfortable anymore with your little box of me and my family or whatever it might be, but you do help out other people. You jump into situations where people have needs and you help them out, and that's good. Those are the kind of things that we want to do to become what James would call a doer of the word, instead of just somebody who gives an assent and just like says, oh yes, I have faith, I have faith, and I believe, I think God's involved in my life, but we really don't do anything about it. Now when you see needs, like you read in James chapter 2, how can you look at somebody that has needs and say, well, have a good day, brother, or have a good day, sister, and not help them out? People that are doing the word won't do that. They're going to actually be involved. I found this when I was working on the James studies back a few years ago in 2008. This article came across in electronically in my desk. But this article, though, that was in Science News, I thought it was interesting in relation to the James study. Because, wow, now there's no background noise. It's so quiet. Can you guys focus? It's that quiet? what it was dealing with is the fact some scientists did some research, and they were looking at the idea of can money make you happy? And much to their surprise, they discovered, well, you know, we've known for a while, that just having money doesn't necessarily make anybody happy. But what they did find out that surprised them the most is that if you have money, you can literally buy happiness with money, but the way you do it isn't by spending it on yourself, it's by spending it on other people. And to science people, that was like a real surprise. They wonder, like, wow, that's very interesting. But at least it can buy happiness when you spend it on others. And what was really shocking to them is that most people seem to be totally unaware until they started delving into like why money had brought these folks happiness and some kind of peace and whatever. The people didn't even realize that the reason their money had brought them happiness is because they had shared that with other people and it helped the lives of other people. But of course, this is all that God's trying to tell us in the Bible, is that when you have a focus on helping other people, if that is the focus of your life, it can bring you a lot of happiness, not just with finances, but with your time and your efforts and your energies in ecclesial life. Now, here's one of the first tests James is going to throw at us, the mirror test. This is great when you're out camping, because of course, when we're out camping, nobody's like in perfect shape. You get up in the morning and you look in those mirrors. We do that every morning. You look and see how bad is the hair, you know, and what's the face look like today? Does it look like I slept? And so what James does is he gives us this mirror test, the idea of looking in a mirror. And you know, we have good mirrors today, so you can see what it's like. So his point is, when he gives you the mirror test down there, what he's after in this case is finding out in verse 23, if anybody's a hearer of the word and not a doer, he's like a man observing his natural face in a mirror, for he observes himself, goes away, and immediately forgets what kind of man he was. So here's a very practical way that you can measure whether you're a doer of the word or a hearer only. So you look in the mirror and you see yourself. Now, are you the kind of person that when you see yourself, when you examine yourself, like on a Sunday morning, and we look at our weaknesses, because that's what we do on a Sunday morning, we examine ourselves. We don't look around the meeting on Sunday morning, look at everybody else and see, like, what are you doing wrong, and what are you doing? We look at ourselves, and we thank our God for his mercy upon ourselves. And when we do that, do we walk out of meeting and then just totally forget what we just considered for a few minutes about how far we fall from the example of our Lord Jesus Christ and issues that we need to work on and things that we're disappointed in ourselves as to how we reacted that week. Well, people that are hearers only, that is what they do. They look in the mirror, they see themselves, realize for a minute what they're really like, and then they walk away and just totally blank it out of their mind, and then you don't have to work on it the rest of the day. Because you just totally forget about your own character. Or you see yourself as something you're really not. Which you can see like in this little guy right here. That's the other thing we can do. We look in the mirror and we see ourselves as somebody we really aren't. But somebody who we think we are. And therefore, there's no need to change. And this is one of the ways we deceive ourselves. We blank it out. We pretend like, well, I'm not really like that. Or we forget in a few minutes. So if that's the kind of person we are, he says, look in verse 24, that what you do is you observe yourself, you go away, and immediately forget what kind of man he was. But what Bible characters will do is they'll look into that perfect law of liberty. Now, this week while you're here at the Bible school, this is really the best time to really think about what you could do different when you get home. Or on the way home sometimes, we used to have discussions when we were going home from Bible schools about what are we going to do different when we get home? What are we going to do extra in ecclesial life? How are we going to change about our own families? We found Bible schools were really a great opportunity to talk to each other and find out, well, what works in your family? What works in your family? Here's an issue we're having trouble with. Can you give me any help? And we would use each other as resources to try to figure out how we can improve our family life and our ecclesial life. So what you can do while you're here this week is just think about it and try to make some commitment about what can you do different when you get home? What else could you do in your ecclesia? What can you get involved in helping out in your family? Or change your family schedule in such a way that maybe we want to bring more of the Bible into our family lives. Maybe we want to start doing a Bible reading at home. If you're not doing that, it's a great idea. You get done with dinner, you know, forget about the cleanup for a minute, but get your Bibles out and you start reading the Bible. And if you have little children and they can't read really well, we use little kids' Bibles. We'd use the children's NIV and find out that even little guys can read the Bible. And we found that even when our kids were really small and they could just first learn to talk, we would do what we just called repeating a verse. So we would start out and we'd say, all right, if you can't read really well, we'd say, okay, in the beginning. That's right. So you're good at this. You did this at home. God created. And that's what we would do. And so even the little kids can learn to start talking about the Bible. And those were just little practical things that we learned from other people and just discussing things at Bible schools and study days that we went to. What actually works in your family? In fact, probably the biggest thing, and I look back in my life, probably the best thing we ever found in a Bible school that we went to was talking to Stan and Wendy Isbell down in Texas about what are you doing down in Texas? And they would tell us, well, down in Texas, we bring our kids out to Bible class on Wednesday night, and we make tabernacle models. And Stan and Wendy were telling us all about how they brought their kids out to their Bible class, to their midweek Bible class. We didn't do that in Detroit. We only had the adults come out. And they were telling us how, we bring out the whole family, all the kids, and what we're doing, we're building models of the tabernacle, and you know, all the kids are doing these projects, and we thought, wow, that's a great idea. We just found that out through conversations at the dinner table. We took that idea home, got a few parents involved, and to this day, and this was probably 30 years ago, and they're still holding kids' classes at probably all of the Detroit area ecclesias now because of that on midweek class night. And they found out that what happened is that because the kids like coming so much, they dragged their parents out to Bible class because they didn't want to miss what was going on at Bible class. Now, that was not as a result of a talk that was given. That wasn't because of going to the Bible school and listening to the classes. That was through conversation at the dinner table. And that was probably one of the most life-changing experiences that I learned at a Bible school, just from talking to other brethren and sisters about what they actually do. So James's point is that if you look into the law of liberty, if you're really examining what he calls the law of liberty, or what Paul refers to as liberty, freedom, for freedom Christ has set us free, it's not the Jewish law, it's not that law, it's the freedom that we have in Christ Jesus, what he calls the law of liberty. It's the fact that you're under the law of Christ now. We're under a law now that allows us the freedom to live like Jesus Christ. You don't have to follow a list of rules and regulations and check off things anymore. Instead, you look at where the needs are in family life and ecclesial life, and you jump in and you get involved in what's needed. What do we need to do here? And that's what you do. And if that is the case, when you look into the law of liberty, then you will become a doer of the word. And this one, he says, will be blessed in what he does. In verse 25 there, in that perfect law of liberty. Now, you can see that all these different Bible characters actually look at that law of liberty, and you can see the impact that it has on them. But Paul talks about the law of liberty and being the freedom that we have to not be under law anymore about putting constraints upon what we can eat. James calls it the perfect law of liberty. Peter warns you not to misuse the liberty. So does Paul in Galatians about, you know, don't misuse your liberty. It's a liberty that we have to help others, which you didn't have under the law. The law would only give you a list of things to say, here's what you have to do. And then when there were other people that had needs, well, you see like in the parable of the Good Samaritan, that wasn't listed there as one of the things, according to the way they interpreted the law. I don't have to help that person out. He's not really my neighbor, and I don't want to be contaminated. But under the law of liberty, we've now been set free to do all the things that we should be doing to help other people in family life and ecclesial life. And for that, we can give thanks. The reading in John that we looked at, in John 8 yesterday, that's really what that was all about. When Christ talked about, you know, if you know the truth will set you free. And it's free from sin, and it's free from the restrictions of this law that he watched these people living under that put constraints upon them. And it prevented them from getting involved in helping out in people's lives because they couldn't find the exact legal rule that said, I have to do that. And instead, they just opted out of those things. So anyways, the freedom that Paul would deal with is now we're set free to serve one another in love. I really think that's him and James are on the same wavelength in Galatians, when he talks about that in Galatians 3. You'll notice at the end of James 1, it's probably worth, for those of you that Bible color, I color my Bible all up all the time, but I noticed in going through there, there's three times where he talks about don't be deceived. And you can see that what James is doing here is he's warning us that it's really easy to look into the mirror and be fooled. It really is. And it's easy to look at our lives and examine ourselves on a Sunday morning and totally fool ourselves about how we're really doing in living this law of liberty and doing becoming a doer of the word. So he said back in verses 16 to 18, be careful. You got to really understand. Don't be deceived. Every good and perfect gift, all the good things that happen in your life and all the good things that happened in their life and in their life and in their life, all those good things that God does for other people, it's okay. You can be happy for them. You can get excited for them because every good and perfect gift is coming down from the Father of lights, from the one from which all the other lights then are going to shine. And he has no partiality. He's not just giving it to people on the basis of who they are. He's out there with a different game plan. He's not showing partiality like we would. He is the Father of lights. So don't be deceived about the good and perfect gifts that God gives you and that he gives other people. Don't be deceived in verse 22. We've got to be a doer of the word and not just a hearer only. And again, he's going to bring up this issue of don't be deceived, and he's going to mention the tongues in verse 26. So if anyone among you thinks he's religious and does not bridle his tongue, so here's another test. So he's trying to give us very specific things that we can look at in our own life and find out, do you really believe that God is involved in your life and that all of these things are happening so that God can change you and work with the other people around you? Or are you just going to react like a person of this world who doesn't believe that? And one of the ways you can make that determination, another one of these little gauges that he gives us, like a little barometer test or a thermometer, so that you can measure something that's hard to see, is how are you doing on controlling your tongue? How are you doing on making sure that you don't lash out at other people when they say things to you, when they do things to you? When something happens in your life that is really not what you wanted to happen right at that moment, how are you doing on controlling what you say? Or are you one of those people that just in anger lashes out at somebody else? And in the quiet of your home, when nobody else is noticing, you talk to your spouse in ways you shouldn't do that. You know, women can do it to men and men can do it to women. Or you talk to your kids in a way that's wrong. And you just lash out at them in anger. How are you really doing on controlling your tongue? Because really, people that believe God's involved in their life, they don't do that. They let the implanted word change the way they react. So this is another one of the little tests that he gave us in verse 26 right there, because if you think you're religious, you think you are, the way you find out is by watching to what extent the Bible is controlling your tongue. How is the spiritual mind doing in here versus the natural mind at controlling what you say? Because it's so easy for this little member right there to just like lash out and say things. And you know, and we can do this in a number of ways. It isn't always that we talk. Sometimes it's we get out those cell phones and we just like crank a text message across to somebody. Or we get on the internet and something comes in about somebody else and we forward it off to all these different people. I mean, that's just like saying it today. It's this lack of control of the tongue. How are we doing on controlling all those things? Are we really doing things that help people because we love them and we care about bringing them along spiritually? Or we just react, just the natural man reacting and doing what we want to do, maybe to make ourselves look better or something like that? Because if that's the case, then we just think we're religious, but we really aren't, and that we've deceived ourselves. And look at what James says about that at the end of verse 26. This is pretty drastic, brothers and sisters. Our tongues give us away. This is such a key thing. James is going to spend all of chapter 3 for the most part. He's going to go into a whole dissertation about the tongue. Because the tongue gives away what you really are. It just watch the things you say during the day. Look at how you react to situations in life. Are you a reactionist? Are you somebody that counts to 10? You think about it and you think, all right, how are we going to help this situation? This is where you find out. One of the tests that he gives us, like the mirror test, to find out how are you really doing, not just deceiving yourselves. Because look at the end of verse 26. If you're not doing that, if your tongue is just like rambling on out of control and you're a reactionist, not a thinker, you haven't really thought these things out, this one's religion is useless. Useless. Because you have what Christ would say, you have a form of religion, but you're denying the power. It just looks good. You go to meeting on a Sunday. You go to Bible class. You might even go to CYC. You go attend all these things. But then when something happens, the tongue just goes wild and you rip on other people or you send out those text messages or you send out email. And we do these things and we destroy other people's lives. And James' point is, well, if that's what you're really doing, then your religion's useless. It's really not helping you develop a spiritual mind. You're not letting the implanted word change the way that you live. That's a pretty drastic thing to say, that the religion is actually useless in that case. So he lays out before us then, on the other hand, pure and undefiled religion. It's good about James. He lays out for you like what you don't want to do, and then on the other hand, he contrasts it with, well, here's what we should be doing. And how are we doing on this? So here's pure and undefiled religion before God. Not a religion that looks good to people by just showing up to meetings and doing things that everybody knows about, but a pure and undefiled religion before God is that you help people who can't help themselves. You get involved, not just with your family, not just with people that can return things back to you. As Christ said, I mean, even the Gentiles do that. It's like, that's not what we're talking about. We're looking at how can you help people who are in situations that they can't help themselves. You go and you visit the orphans and you visit the widows and their troubles. I mean, that was really all over the law if people had read their law carefully about taking care of the widows and the orphans and defending the cause of the needy. You go back in the prophets and you look in the minor prophets. So often God condemned the nation of Israel because they didn't do this. Instead, they just did all the things that looked good. They had a form of religion, but it had no power to change the way they lived. So we get out there and we help people in ecclesial life and family life who cannot help themselves or who are in need and don't have anybody else who's going to jump in and help them. And you keep yourself unspotted from the world. What a great balance James has. He says, look, you've got to be involved in helping others. And to really be effective at helping others, you've got to work on yourself. You've got to keep yourself uninfluenced by all these things. And see, what would happen in life a lot of times today is brethren and sisters think that in order for me to do this and keep myself unspotted from the world, I've got to withdraw. I've got to go like into isolation. I don't want to get contaminated by all those things happening out there. James doesn't let you do that. He says, first of all, you go out and help people. Get involved in people's lives. Help them out, and at the same time, make sure you're not contaminated by that. Keep yourself unspotted from the world. So don't let the behavior of these people you're going to run into, don't let it change your life. You keep working on yourself while you're helping in ecclesial life. It's a great balance that he has here. He really is. It's a wonderful letter for looking at how he balances out these issues of becoming doers of the word and living as family members of God's family. So that's pretty much the way James leaves the end of chapter 1. And of course, you can look at what kind of religion you have. That's why we're here this week, is to try to figure out what kind of religion do we have. Do we have a religion that just looks good from the outside, but internally it really can't change the way we live? Now, chapter 2. What he's going to do in chapter 2, and he's going to look at this idea of how real faith will actually change how you treat other people. And he's going to go again. He's going to give us another test. And this time he's going to expand on this idea of partiality. I threw that one in just in case some of you are wondering about that website again. Now, I don't know how much you guys access that from Australia. You could probably just put in www.livoniatapes.com. Does that work from over here? Or do you have to put in a U.S. stuff? That's it. You just put that in and you're good. So that's the website that Andrew set up for all of you to use. He literally has thousands of Christadelphian talks on there. Australians probably, a lot of Australian classes, because that's what we all started out with. He called it Livonia Tapes because at the time I was taking all my cassette tapes and converting them over to MP3s. Now what's happening, though, is that people are taking classes like this Bible school all over the world this week, and they're uploading them into this website. So it's really, it's just becoming an ongoing, growing electronic library. And when you get on this library right there, what you can do is a search over here. You can just go to search classes, and you can put in a topic. So like, for example, today, if you put in James, you would find out, it would come back to you and list for you all the different brethren that have given classes on James, and then you can select what you want. Usually the name of the class is there, and he also is collecting like the date in which it was given, so you can have an idea. Like if somebody did a study twice and it was a 10-year period in between, you can pick out the more recent one or the older version, whatever you like. And then he lists for you on the page when it first pops up, he lists the latest things that have just popped up. So the day that I pulled this off the website, on September 27th, somebody had just done a study. It was at Brother Don Luff on the Vineyard of the Lord. So Don Luff would be a fellow from Ontario. Anyways, you can see there's all different ones that are up there. Some of them are young people, some of them are older folks, and then there's some in England, there's South Africa, there's Australia, they're all over the place in the world. So, on to James chapter 2. Now, what James does is he laid out at the end of chapter 1, and this is really probably a practical thing to remember. As you're reading through James chapter 1, he's going to give you like a thesis statement, all the things he really wants to deal with. And then in chapters 2, 3, 4, and 5, all he's going to do is expand on the things that he already listed for us. So he's already mentioned partiality, that God is not like that. He's the Father of lights, in whom there is no shadow due to turning. He's not like the things that actually move and change over time. He's just perfectly exposing his lights to the people, to the lights he's trying to get to reflect his glory. He's going to talk about the tongue in chapter 3. He's going to talk about being a doer of the word at the end of chapter 2. He's going to go into this whole issue about how faith, if you really have a faith that's active, you won't be able to stop from becoming a doer of the word, and you're going to help other people out. He mentioned wisdom in chapter 1 at verse 5 there, and he's going to deal with that again in chapter 3. The fighting in the wars, when he talked about how, you know, this should calm us down, that the wrath of God doesn't produce the righteousness, the wrath of man doesn't produce the righteousness of God. He's going to deal with that specifically in chapter 4. So you look at all these different topics that are there, and all he's going to do is revisit them and give us more detail on all these topics that he's already mentioned. All these things were already in chapter 1. And so there really isn't a whole lot new in the rest of the letter. It's just more of what he's already listed for us at the beginning. And now he's going to expand them out. In case you didn't get it the first time around, here's what I really meant. That's about what James does. And he fills us in with a little bit more detail. So I know that's going to go too fast for most of you, but don't forget, the PowerPoints are on the website too. So I think maybe with Jeremy, those of you that get the classes, see, we can hopefully put the PowerPoints right on your CDs for you if you want. We do that back home. We usually get people see now they have the PowerPoints and the classes, and that way you can have it all. Or if you've got a thumb drive this week and you want to put all the PowerPoints on your thumb drive, you're welcome to do that. Or if you brought a computer, which I saw some of you did, I'll put the classes on a thumb drive and you can just upload them onto your own computer. So here's another test. This is, you know, we got the mirror test now. We've got the test about our tongue that he's mentioned. Here's another one. What about favoritism? Are we the kind of person that shows favoritism in family and ecclesial life? And then he's going to look later on in this chapter about whether we've got an act of faith that's really expressed in works of faith. Not works of law, works of faith, which are really a whole different avenue of a pathway of life. So the first one he's going to tackle is this idea of prejudice. Do we show favoritism in ecclesial life? And really, I think for all of us, we probably all have to say, yeah, we're all guilty of this. We all have some kind of prejudice in ecclesial life. This is just human nature. These are areas that we have to work on. And what he says it is, it's caused by these evil thoughts that we have about other people that leads us to misjudge them. So he's going to look at this whole issue in chapter 2 about, well, how are we doing on working on our prejudice in ecclesial life? He starts out with the Lord of glory. In verse 1, it's possible that it could be a reference to like the way the Apostle Paul uses this about the Lord of glory when they refer to Jesus Christ as having crucified the Lord of glory. That's a possibility. It may be a reflection back on chapter 1 and verse 17 there when he talked about the Father of lights. But when he deals with this on the Lord of glory, he's looking at this concept of God's glory. When the glory of God went out, there was no shadow due to change. It wasn't like the sun creating shadows based on the sundial. God's glory goes out and it affects everybody. It's not a prejudice type of glory. It's not on some and not on others. Our God is very different from that way. He doesn't show partiality. So what he deals with then is, all right, how are we doing on looking at partiality? Are we the kind of person who judges people based on their outward appearance? Do we judge people based upon their economic status in life? When somebody walks into the meeting, like you just did, do we look at them and find out, well, what is she wearing? All right, what kind of stuff does she have? What kind of car did she drive when she pulled in the parking lot? What kind of tent did she put up over there? She got one of the little tents, and she got one of those nice trailers. And we look at people, and we look at all these outward show things. We do this, brethren and sisters, and we show partiality to people based upon all this outward stuff. And if you don't do that, then you really let the truth have a great impact in your life. This is where we all start. And for the kids right now, I know it goes on with kids too. We're all like this. This is where we start. These are the areas that we have to work on. I used to see this in school all the time, where a new student would walk in the classroom and everybody would size them up based on how they look, what they're wearing, and you know, then as soon as they open their mouth and talk, then you judge them based on their accent that they have, and you start to try to make a decision about where they came from, and all this stuff goes on. This is what we do by nature. And so we have to fight this. Because our tendency, he says, is look at, we give people that are all dressed up and they look like they're people of wealth and they have all this dignity. We say, oh, come on up here. Have this, oh, don't sit on that hard seat. Sit on the cushy couch. You know, and we give them the best seat. And somebody poor walks in the door over there, or maybe somebody who comes from a different background, it doesn't look like maybe they even talk our language, and we just sort of let them wander in the back and hide out back over there. And I'm not sure I even want to talk to them. This is how we are, brethren and sisters, as people. And James throws this out. This isn't me. He throws this out as an example of how are you doing on reflecting the character of God. Otherwise, we just fool ourselves. We go out to the meetings, we say, oh, I was there. And we forget the fact that somebody walked in the door over there I should have talked to and I didn't. Or I should have made them feel welcome. Or a young person came in, maybe with a different background, doesn't quite dress the way that we dress. And so I wrote them off because their hair is too long or because their clothes aren't the right clothes. And I should have gone over there and talked to them and thanked them for coming, made them feel welcome. And so what James does is he gives us these specifics like this. And he says, look at, this is how you find out if your religion really matters. Or do you just have a form of religion and your religion is useless because it doesn't change how you live? This is pretty drastic stuff. This isn't just like, you know, something you can just sort of look at and say, well, maybe I'll implement this, maybe I won't. He lays this out and says, if you do this, brethren and sisters, he says, you become judges with evil thoughts. That's not the King James says that you're judges of evil thoughts, and we try to think of, oh, we're judging other people. Oh, no, he says, you are a judge. You've made yourself the judge, and you've got evil thoughts in your head about that other person. This is our problem, not theirs. We have the problem. And so his warning is that, look, if that's the way we're living right now, if we're showing partiality to each other, then this is an area that we have to work on because God doesn't do that. He doesn't show favoritism based on those things. He doesn't care what kind of car you drive. He doesn't care the kind of clothes that you wear and your economic status that you are, because he puts you in that economic status. And he doesn't expect you to do things that are beyond your means. He doesn't want you to go into debt so that we can maybe look good in our Christadelphian community and drive the right kind of car and buy the right kind of house so that we look like we're part of the community. He's given us our economic status. What he wants out of us is that implanted word to grow in our mind and to change the way that we think. So as James says, you know, God doesn't show this kind of favoritism, and neither should his kids. If you're a child of God, you'll learn to live like God. He's the Father of lights, for with whom there is no shadow due to turning. He doesn't just like treat people differently based upon what they wear and all this kind of stuff. He desires all men to be saved, like Paul would say. There is only one God and one mediator. There's only one. There isn't a God of the rich and a God of the poor. There's not a God of the Jews and a God of the Gentiles. There is only one God. And this was the issue that came up early on, Acts 10. Remember when Peter saw the vision where the sheet came down and all the animals were there? And the angel said to Peter, "Rise, Peter, kill and eat." And he learned from that God doesn't show partiality. Oh, I thought he did. I thought the Jews were special. You know, and maybe that's how we are. We think Christadelphians are special. We're the ones. And that God somehow shows partiality to us and not to those other people. That really isn't true, brothers and sisters. He wants all of his family to be saved. He wants us to exhibit his love to all of them. And so this was an issue that became a very important one. You can see it here in Romans 2, Ephesians 6, Colossians 3, 1 Peter 2. Partiality was a big issue in the first century ecclesia. Paul wrote to Timothy warning him about doing all these things without partiality. And this is one of the tests that James throws out at us. How are we doing when somebody walks in the meeting? When a brother comes in from another ecclesia, or a sister, or they come in with their family, and they come into meeting on a Sunday, how are we doing at not showing partiality to people based upon their economic status, based upon the accent that they have, based upon the car they drove up in? How are we doing on not showing partiality? Because look at what he says as his example right here. He said, look it, hasn't God chosen the poor of this world to be rich in faith? That was God's choice. He didn't choose the rich necessarily. He's chosen people from low economic statuses because those are the people he can work with. My tendency, and yours, is to want to go after folks that are different from that. We give much more favoritism to those that are rich and people that have money and people that are higher class. That is our natural tendency. And so we've got to look out for the poor. We've got to look out for those that come from other economic statuses because God's chosen them. This is back to chapter 1, that the poor man glory in his exaltation. He's been brought up in Christ Jesus and raised up into the heavenlies. And those are going to be heirs of the kingdom, which he's promised to those that are love him. See, this is God's choice, brethren and sisters. He's chosen the poor of this world, the rich of those faith, those that to be rich in faith. But in verse 6, look at, you have dishonored the poor man. You have, because of the way you've treated him. And then he goes on to say, but look at these people that you give so much, you know, credibility to, and you treat them so nice. These are the rich people that walk in the door over there. Aren't those the ones that cause all your trouble? Those are the people that are persecuting you. They're the ones that in the end, they blaspheme the name of our God. And they drag you into courts and they want some of your stuff. Because maybe they've done something or you've done something in their life and they can get more money out of you. And those are the ones that are squeezing you dry. And so James said, look at, you know, in verse 5 right there, that God's chosen them. But in verse 6, you've dishonored the poor man. Do not the rich oppress you and drag you into courts? Do not they blaspheme that noble name by which you are called? That's what the rich people were doing at this point in life. Now, hang on to that idea because you're going to see this will come up again in chapter 5 if we get there on Friday. And you'll see that chapter 5 starts off all about the oppression of the rich in this case. So this issue of the rich and the poor evidently was quite a big issue at this time. And what they were doing is showing favoritism to the rich, even though in the end it was going to be these rich people that would drag them into courts and try to take advantage of them. So James would say, look, how in the world can you show favoritism to them? But we do. Well, that's the way it is. And then he goes on to say, look, if you really fulfill, because he knows what they're thinking. They're thinking, all right, I'm fulfilling the royal law. The royal law was to love my neighbor as myself. So when rich brother walks in the door over there, I have to show him the love of God. I'll invite him over to my house. I'll take good care of him because he's the rich brother. And I'm really fulfilling the royal law. And this is what they were thinking. So this is the mind of the flesh. This is what we do. We deceive ourselves. And we think we're fulfilling the law of Christ. But what we're really doing is that we're just using the Bible, as they did. These people used their Bibles, but they used the Bible in a very limited way that fit what they wanted to do. I want to show favoritism to this rich man. I want to come over to the house. I feel comfortable with him. Maybe I'll get something out of him in the end. These people are the ones I feel comfortable with, not the poor man. So I'll say, look, I'm fulfilling the law of Christ because Christ says that we should love our neighbor as ourselves. And I'm going to look at neighbor as the people that are higher class. That's my idea of neighbor, which was really why Jesus gave that parable about which one proved to be neighbor. Because folks, we tend to draw little boxes in there, and we limit that law in the Old Testament. We limit that passage. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. You really do well. But in verse 9, he goes on and says, if you show partiality, you commit sin, and you're convicted by the law as a transgressor. So he says, look, here's what really happens. If you show partiality, you think you're fulfilling the Bible. You think you've got Bible passages in your mind, and I'm loving my neighbor as myself, but my neighbor is just those people. If that's the case, then what you're really doing is you're showing partiality. And even the law condemned that. And he's thinking back to Leviticus 19, that you shall do no injustice in judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor, nor dishonor the person of honor the person of the mighty. In righteousness you shall judge your neighbor. Did you ever notice that in the law? When God gave that rule about partiality, he gave the rule and said, look it, if you're really like God, you don't look at the rich person and show them favoritism, and you don't look at the poor person and show them favoritism. He actually looked at both aspects of the pendulum. And he forbade that in the law and said, what you're really supposed to do is be honest. And you're supposed to show justice based on the issues, not based on the fact whether somebody was poor or somebody was rich. The NIV says, do not pervert justice. Do not show partiality to the poor or favoritism to the great. But judge your neighbor fairly. That's the way it was supposed to be. But unfortunately, that isn't really the way it actually worked out. So this is the problem that they were bringing into ecclesial life, and you could see where it came from. It came from the Jewish Judaistic background. It came from their system that they had, their religious system of that time. They were thinking that they could keep the law and they could earn their salvation. This is the Jewish mind. If I keep all these things that are in the law, I'm going to build up all these good things I do. I'm going to show God what a good person I am, and I'm going to earn my salvation. And this is like what I call the bottom-up kind of salvation. You do it from the bottom up, thinking I'm going to earn it, and it's all this stuff I got to do according to the law. But the problem is, I can't keep the whole law. I know I can't. I'm going to make some mistake. So what I'll do to cover my tracks is I'll take all the things that I'm not good at, and I'll just say, well, those things really weren't important. And the other things that I'm really good at, those are the ones God cares about. And so I'm going to go around and look at everybody else and say, what's your problem? You can't keep this? I'm doing just fine at this one. You can't do that? Well, I'm doing just fine. And I don't even look at those little things anymore that I call them little, that I'm no good at, because I don't want to deal with those. Like maybe my problem was that I get really angry or something like that, and that's my tendency. So I look at the law then, and I emphasize all the other things, but not anger, because that's the one I'm not good at. This is what Jews did. And they elevated those things that were in the law that they could keep, and they made those the important ones, and they just stressed those laws, and they didn't stress the others. And this is what Jesus went after them for, is that and so James would point out to them and say, look, if you're really honest about this, if you're guilty in one point of the law, whatever that is, you're guilty of the whole law, and there's no way you can present yourself to God that way as somebody who was a keeper of the law. You see, he's referring back there to Deuteronomy 27. Cursed is the one who does not confirm all the words of this law. And the people had to say amen. Or what Paul brings up when he's dealing with the same issue in Galatians 5. And he says, I testify again to every man who becomes circumcised, you're a debtor to keep the whole law, if that's the route you want to go down. And be thankful in Christ Jesus, we don't have to have that. We're not under that. So I'll just finish up then with the two issues on adultery that he brings up, right? I think it's fun. We'll probably finish up around verse 13 today. But he brings up these examples. Verse 11, he says, look it, for he who said, do not commit adultery, also said, do not murder. Now, when you read that, don't commit adultery and don't commit murder, where does your mind immediately go? Where does your mind go? Oh, Ten Commandments, that's true. But if you're thinking about a Bible character, David. I mean, and this is what James is going to do. He's going to throw at them some Bible characters to think about. So he throws at them the example of David. You know, he said, don't commit adultery, also said, do not murder. This man did them both. But you might be really good, brethren and sisters, at not doing one of those, but you might not be so good at doing the other one. And so what James is going to point out is that even though you're doing good at, I don't murder, if you're the brother or the sister who has tendencies to look at somebody else's spouse and you covet that spouse, you covet somebody else's, then you've committed this other one. And if that's the case, even though you're not a murderer,
Don't condemn the murderers. You're as guilty as they are, because if you do one, you do the other, and David did them both. And in the end, this is what happens when you start showing partiality. We rank the laws, and we think the laws that I can follow, those are the important ones. And the ones that I mess up on, those are just the little things. This is what happens with the mind of the Judaizer. And so he tries to bring them some practical examples like that, and he speaks to those who were going to be judged by the law of liberty, as he points out. Now, when you look at our favoritisms today, you start to say, well, how does this apply to us today? We maybe don't have the exact same problem James did, but we still have favoritism. You look down the line, we judge people all the time based upon the clothes they wear. We judge them based on the cars that they drive, their skin color, the country that they're from. This is what we do. Maybe from the ecclesia that they came from and what ecclesia they belong to, because, I know what that ecclesia believes. And we judge people based on all these outside things. Maybe their family name, because we know something about their family. Some people judge people on their wealth, their gender, their education. We even have people today who judge us on the basis of the Bible version we use. Are you a King James user, or are you using something else? Are you using one of those modern versions? This is what happens in our life. I grew up with this. It was that way in the United States, too. Got judged for, I used to use an RSV, and people looked really down on me because I wasn't reading a King James Bible. We do all kinds of stuff. We have Christadelphians today who judge people on the basis of using the Yahweh name. I mean, this should not be so, brothers and sisters. This is not the right way to live. These are not the critical issues of life. We've got to learn to not show those kind of favoritisms. This is the kind of stuff we don't want to do. We want to bring people into our community and show them the love of God and provide them a positive atmosphere and framework for them and their families to grow. We don't want to get caught up in those favoritisms. Because as James says here in verse 13, when he talks about this issue, for judgment is without mercy to the one who has shown no mercy. I'll tell you, I boxed that verse in my Bible. That to me is one of the key things he's after right now. This whole issue of favoritism that he's going after, why this matters. If we don't show mercy to each other, brothers and sisters, and to our brothers and sisters' children, and to the mistakes that we have all made as a community, if we don't show mercy, he says, look at, judgment is without mercy to the one who has shown no mercy. And that's why he leaves us with this issue that mercy triumphs over judgment. And just think about yourselves when you're standing before the Lord Jesus Christ at the judgment seat and you're looking back over your life and the things that you have done. Who's going to tell Christ what great things they've done? What we're going to be doing is standing there just begging for the mercy of God, appealing to him on the basis of his righteousness and the changes that he's made in us, hoping that his mercy will cover all the mistakes that we have made. And if that's what we want, brethren and sisters, then we have to show it to everybody else. This is what happens when you are a doer of the word and not just a hearer only. So we'll pick it up in chapter 2 there tomorrow. Thanks.